wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, your listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Today we welcome back an old friend of the Old Mole, Tammy Dean, who will be engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today on our program, Desiree Helligers talks with fossil fuel activist Bonnie McKinley and Sean Fleek of Opal Environmental Justice about climate change in Oregon politics. We conclude our program today with an interview with Alex Diamond. Alex Diamond has been teaching in Columbia for the past several years and until recently had been living in a remote community long an area of struggle between guerrillas and paramilitaries and the government. While there, his research focused on the implementation of the peace accords between FARC and the Colombian government and the transition in areas previously under insurgent control. The interview will focus on an article he has recently published in NACLA Report, an acronym for the North American Congress on Latin America. Leading off our program today, Bill Resnick talks with Micah Yai. Micah Yai taught many years in the Portland public schools in and around Portland. She's now at the PSU School of Education, teaching the basics and supervising student teachers interning in classrooms. Her specialty is teaching reading. They discuss the basic principles and practices that help children learn to read, love learning, and want to understand and express themselves. They also critique corporate school reform that emphasizes accountability, that through constant student testing and using rote programs and very little real reading of imaginative literature, this particularly being required mostly in classrooms of low-income children.
Micah Yai, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here.
Micah Yai is a teacher, taught many years in the public schools in and around Portland. She's now a teacher of teachers and a supervisor of student teachers interning in classrooms. She identifies herself as a passionate literacy educator who advocates for children from all backgrounds. So, Micah Yai, you've been doing this for, 20-some years now, I think, looking at your vita. Seen a lot of schools and their programs. Your research was in teaching reading, and you know that literature. Give us an overview of teaching reading. What's been learned? What are the basic principles and practices that help children to learn to read and love learning and want to understand and express themselves, which really is the idea of an elementary school?
It really is. I would say that one of the key ingredients for helping children learn how to read is giving them time to read, giving them books that they want to read and interact with. Having them understand stories, and then being really strategic in how you go about teaching them how to read those books. So, I mean, first you really want kids interacting with books that they love, having time to talk about those books, look at the pictures in the books, start understanding the words of those books, seeing themselves within the book, so having materials that are really culturally appropriate and responsive, and then slowly teaching them the skills that they need for reading.
Yeah, it seems sort of natural if you just look at your own life. Well, I learned how to read. Mm-hmm. But really, it's like learning the violin. It seems to me that there are all of these intellectual, mental skills that have to be developed to really read well and to read with understanding and to be able to put yourself into the story and read, you know, as sort of a participant observer almost, and in a discussion with the author. All those things are not natural. They really are developed in the same way that a violin, you know, or learning a musical instrument.
Right.
Good teaching then somehow helps develop that.
Absolutely.
How do you deal with that as a teacher of teacher?
Yeah, I would say that that's absolutely true. You are developing those skills. You want kids to have a lot of opportunity where they are navigating language and understanding that there are stories in books, that books have meaning, that when they read something, it's for understanding. There are a lot of reading programs that are really just looking at the skills of reading versus really comprehension. And comprehension is really that outcome that you want students to have. And so when we work with our teacher future candidates, we want them to understand that they, when they're in their classroom with kids, they are going to help kids break reading down and then put those pieces back together. So they need to understand letter sounds. They need to be able to chunk words. So they need to do these phonetic skills.
All of those skills.
Right. And a lot of ways that classroom teachers can help students with reading is to give them opportunities to write. Write is one of the best reading instructional tools, where they have time to write what they want to write, write stories, and then they're navigating letter sounds and putting those together and understanding that what they write and what they read, there should be meaning to that.
Right. But that's, of course, all motivated. People want to be part of the group, and they want to express themselves, and they want to be liked and
yes.
appreciated. And that's a way of gaining it. So there's tremendous motivation, I think, in children to learn. And yep. that's what sort of drives it. But you have to give them an opportunity to do that.
Right.
And not just discipline and constantly rote learning as if, in fact, which is only done to poor people.
Right. Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of times, you're right, where kids will be, before they get to the good parts, teachers will say, well, until you can understand your phonics, you don't get to have time to read for pleasure, which is actually counterproductive, because what you want is kids sitting down and having that opportunity and that time. In elementary classrooms, and actually I believe older kids too, you should have time to sit down, write freely, and read books you want to read, even if you're just reading the pictures and sitting down with a buddy and going through
right.
the pictures together,
and
having that time.
And reading and drawing, expression is sort of, you can draw and read at the same time. These kids with a book that you can even draw on, although some of them do, they have the opportunity and to practice letters and all of them, and then to express it, it's, I mean, if you break it down into all of the things that happen, it's so complicated, creating a really good reader and someone able to articulate. And you have years of practice, like in a violin. It takes 10 years to be really good. Well, it takes more than that to be really, really good at, I mean, the intellectual skills are so complicated and need practice. But, of course, people want to do that. Once they begin understanding, they want to understand more. It's not like it's a huge burden, like in playing a good instrument.
Right. Well, that's true. I think, I mean, once you start understanding that letters can be put together to make words, and that if you're on the bus or in a car and you see signs, you want to read all of that environmental print. And that's a lot of impetus. You see other kids doing those things in a classroom. There'll be someone who, you could ask children, who's a good reader in this classroom? And usually they want to be like that person because they know there is meaning in books, and they want to be able to have access. It helps kids. They feel smart. They feel accomplished. And everybody wants those things.
What about children from homes where parents cannot provide, as generally in many affluent homes, where they just don't have the capacity or the time or can build the experiences mm-hmm. or even provide the sort of health care and food that kids need and who are always moving around? How about these children? Do they need a kind of a different curriculum, or do they just have to start the curriculum a little earlier? I'm asking that because there are so many, and indeed some educators, who have different curriculums for the different classes for kids who are doing poorly or don't have the skills that others have when they come into kindergarten. They're cordoned off and given junk stuff rather than real literacy materials. So.
Right.
I gather you find that to be revolting.
I do. You can see me shaking my head. I think first thing is the notion that a kid coming into kindergarten, you hear this often, that they're not ready for school or that they're behind. And it's my belief that if a child comes into kindergarten, you can't be behind. That's where everybody has started. And so it's the role of the teacher then to make sure that whatever you think kids need that they aren't getting outside of the classroom that would help them be successful in school, you are going to provide that within the classroom. So instead of giving children whose families may not have books in their home, whose parents are working swing shifts where they don't have time to help their kids with literacy, where their first language at home may not be English, whatever it is, you are going to end up providing them with more with time to do the same things that you would for kids who already have some of those pieces in place that help them be more successful in this system. So there's some strategies that you can help families with that are that when I've worked with kindergarten parents who are from, let's say, lower incomes or are working different shifts where they don't have time to work with their kids because they're at work, is you can teach them how to talk to them about oral storytelling. You can have them write little notes back and forth to their children. There's different strategies you can do. If you're on the bus or in the car, you can look for some of those signs, and you can just have conversations with your children so they get more words. The main thing to think about with reading is kids who navigate, if you encounter more words, your vocabulary increases, and the more words you have, the more words you will learn, and so on.
This is KBLU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Michael Yai, a teacher, taught many years in the public schools in and around Portland. She's now a teacher of teachers and supervises the teacher training programs. We've been talking about the qualities of a good reading program and a good school, and that all children will want to learn, but we have to tailor some of it, the readings and discussions, to individual kids. I guess that's why teachers want to have smaller classes. When you have 40 young kids in a classroom, you just can't. It's both emotional for young kids. It's an emotional bond with the teacher, as well as having a special sort of, I mean, treating each kid individually. You can't do it, it seems to me.
Yeah, it's really challenging because when you need to have the relationships with kids, and then you need teachers who are, they understand the needs of each child. And if you have 20 children versus 30 children, I mean, the work just grows exponentially. And so if you really want teachers to help kids with reading, the classes do need to be relatively small so they can help them. One thing that teachers who are skilled in reading instruction know is they need to find the right books for kids. And they need to help kids understand how to find those books for themselves so they become independent readers. And you want them to have books that they can practice things with, books that they can enjoy, books, you can a whole variety of books, but it takes time to teach kids that. And then the teacher is monitoring those kids, meeting with kids who need extra or a push forward. But to really understand their needs, there needs to be fewer kids in a classroom. If there's too many, it's really impossible.
Yeah, you know, rich people in this country who are organized to push at the schools, they insist that class size really doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's just teacher, if they're good, they're good, regardless of class size. And yet when they send their kids to private schools, they not only have 10 or 12 kids in the class, they have more than one teacher and more than one aide and give a huge amount of individual attention to some kids who may need it. But for the rest of the people, that's completely unnecessary, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems to me where what we've come into in the United States now is we can't afford to teach these kids, but of course they can afford anything for their children. And what they choose is to create privileged, highly privileged and kids with skills, at least.
Well, two things that are interesting, well, a lot of that's interesting in what you said, but two things that kind of stand out to me, first of all, is the notion that teachers, you know, it's a gift, or teachers can just do it. Because actually, I mean, it takes a lot of skills to be able to be a teacher. And I know I work with my teacher candidates all the time where they feel like there is this mantra that, oh, you must just, you know, some of these teachers are just gifted. They just naturally do it. And no, there's a lot of skills that teachers are building and building. It's a lot of work to build those skills. And if you want to have people who really understand reading and children, it's a lot of work for them to understand that. We don't want reading programs that de-skill those teachers. We want them to have those skills. There are some places really close to Portland that actually have put money into low-income schools right across the river in Evergreen School District, and some of their low-income elementary schools, their kindergarten are capped I think it's at around 20. And if it goes above 24, the teacher gets an assistant in the classroom. They have in some of the schools, they have reading specialists that are assigned part-time to a grade level where they get a lot of support. And so they have chosen to put their money that direction. There's other districts, you know, this side of the Columbia River where the class sizes get really big for young children. And that's where you do see kids falling through the cracks. I've yet to meet a teacher who didn't want to do well. My own kids have, my son just graduated from Portland Public Schools, and I have a daughter who's in 11th grade in Portland Public Schools. They have had excellent teachers. It's not the teachers. It's the system that puts too many children into classrooms, programs that de-skill teachers of young children, and then, of course, the social issues that come along with poverty and those sorts of issues, mobility. I would say there are a lot of things in the Portland area that are going well, too. Like, a lot of teachers have embraced doing writing workshops and doing reading workshops where there are more choices. I think it's really helping support teachers understand, give them time to get to know their children, probably fewer mandates for data tracking, but if they are tracking data on kids, helping them understand how to use that for real instructional purposes instead of collecting data that goes into a district office. It's really using it for instruction and helping kids, helping teachers understand how to structure their room giving them the opportunity to structure their classroom so they have kids have the time, and also teachers can use the skills that they have. Teachers who are coming into the profession who have been around a long time, they have a lot of skills, and we want them to use those skills with children. And giving them the opportunity to use those skills is just critical.
This is your Mo Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick talking to Micah Yai, who has taught for years as well as now is a professor at Portland State and teaches teachers and also supervises new teachers in schools and has seen many, many, many schools. Micah Yai, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill. I always enjoy it.
Now a good friend of mine sat with me and he cried. He told me a story, I know he hadn't lied. He said he went for a job, and this the man said, without an education, you might as well be dead. Now don't get me wrong, he said it's not who you are, but people come to me from a near and far.
Well, there you have it from the King of Soul, James Brown. Get an education. Don't drop out. This is KBOO Portland, and you are listening to the OMO Variety Hour. Now Desiree Hellinger interviews fossil fuel activist Bonnie McKinley about the global climate implications of the Oregon governor's election. She also speaks with Sean Fleek of Opal Environmental Justice about the Oregon Just Transition's upcoming event, Rise for Climate, Jobs and Justice. Desiree?
So my guest today is Bonnie McKinley, who has been a tireless organizer involved in the fossil fuel fight in the Pacific Northwest. Bonnie has been working with Stopped Fracked Gas PDX, along with three regional coalitions, Stand Up to Oil, Power Past Coal, and Power Past Fracked Gas. Bonnie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
So it's not often that we can say that an Oregon election may actually have global implications, but that may well be the case this time. Can you fill us in a little bit about what you think is at stake in the Oregon governor's election?
Well, there are five candidates for governor in the 218 race. Just want to make it clear that I think it's really important to acknowledge all the candidates and hope that all can be involved in any debates. You know, sometimes it just gets limited to the Democratic and Republican candidates. But there is a Constitution Party candidate named Aaron Orr, who's promoting life, liberty, and limited government. Independent Rick Starnes, who I don't know much about his candidacy or his issues, but he's single issue, and his single issue is campaign finance reform, which is very appealing. We need to keep big money out of elections. The Green Party candidate is Alexis de Blasio, and I personally don't know too much about him, but the Green Party's 10 Keene Valley values are much to be respected, and I agree with them. And then the Republican candidate is Bend State Rep. Newt Bueller. And Newt Bueller does acknowledge that climate change is real and human caused, but he does support fast track, actually, for the permitting of Oregon's biggest climate busting project, the proposed Jordan Cove Energy Project, and its accompanying 230-mile Pacific Connector pipeline. So it's disconcerting to me. I don't think we have much hope of flipping Newt on that. Governor Kate Brown, our incumbent, has not come out for or against the project. It's a dual project. You need the pipeline to ship the gas to Coos Bay, where it's proposed to have a terminal, where the gas will be liquefied and super chill it and make it shrink it in size so it can be loaded on tankers and delivered to Asia. So we have, for the entirety of Kate Brown's term of office, have encouraged her to come out strongly. The tribes and impacted residents, all members from the climate and environmental community, have encouraged her to take a position. She says that she cannot do that at this time, and she does say that she'll make sure that her office sees that the permitting process is conducted fairly. So we have had rallies, have bird dogged her at political events, made ads, letters, many phone calls, and so we're hoping that she will take a stand. And she's given actually a lot of indications that she will. She has made some pretty powerful statements on climate. She says that global warming is the biggest threat to Oregon's environment, our economy, our way of life. My personal favorite quote from her is, and she said this more than once in a number of occasions, future generations will judge us not on the fact of global change, but on what we do to tackle it. And
global climate change. Yeah.
I think that's very significant. At a Friday Forum City Club last May, she also said, Oregon continues to play a leading role in tackling global climate change. We must pursue innovative solutions to reduce carbon emissions while growing the clean energy economy. So we who are battling these projects, these proposals, hope that she will take a similar stand that our Senator Merkley did. He made a very important statement that I have to quote him on. This is Senator Jeff Merkley. I cannot turn away from the knowledge that, like other large-scale fossil fuel projects, Jordan Cove will contribute massively to pollution that is profoundly damaging our state and our world. Generations from now, our grandchildren will wonder why we continue to burn fossil fuels when the catastrophic consequences were so evident. So of the five candidates, we think that it's most likely that Governor Brown will take a stand. It's inconsistent for her not to. She's taken a number of courageous stands. She has said no use of Oregon's National Guard to protect the U.S.-Mexican border, and she's been quite vocal on that, and we admire and are very grateful to her for that. And she's taken a very strong stand for Oregon's 30-year sanctuary law and has, in fact, strengthened it, whereas Republican candidate Newt Bueller has come out strongly to repeal the sanctuary law, and that will be on the Oregon ballot in November, ballot measure 105. People may remember Oregon's for immigration reform. We're collecting signatures for initiative petition number 22. And we and all my colleagues and a number of organizations, such as the Sierra Club and Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, ACLU, all are very strongly opposed to repealing Oregon's strong sanctuary law. Ballot Measure 105, I hope people vote opposed to it. And I just want to say that Oregon is facing its biggest climate-busting project with the Coos Bay Energy Project and the Pacific Connector Pipeline. That pipeline is proposed to be 230 miles from Malin, which is east of Klamath, and it would create a permanent 90-foot-wide clear cut, which would disrupt and break up animal habitat, would affect farmers and landowners, and serious implications for tribal burial sites, tribal cultural sites, and tribal fishing and economic security. It would be a massive dredging project. Once built, if it was built, and we hope it certainly is never built, it would use the biggest amount of energy Oregon's ever seen. It's slated to go under five major rivers, the Coos, Coquille, Umpqua, Rogue, and Klamath, and hundreds of smaller waterways. And to top it all off, it's proposed to be built in a fragile earthquake tsunami area, and we know that we're overdue for an earthquake off our west coast. So it's pretty bad. It's fracked gas, which in the first 20 years in the Earth's atmosphere, the methane gas contains 86 times more greenhouse gas emissions than carbon dioxide. So it would be the biggest greenhouse gas emitter in the state. And we very much want her to oppose it, and I'm pretty hopeful that she will. It would be the biggest fracked gas, way biggest frack gas proposal on the West Coast. And then we're looking at the world's largest methanol is frack gas, proposed refinery just downriver in Kalama. You know, that's even closer to the Portland area. Of course, proximity in geography doesn't really matter when we think it's the whole planet, and we're concerned about the whole planet and all of its human and non-human inhabitants. So I can say who I might hope people vote for. That's a very personal decision, and voting is just one thing that people can do. Actually, in some ways it can have great implications, but there's a lot people can do by learning a lot, talking it up to people, sharing information, joining organizations, starting their own organizations. We have a very sweet and collaborative force, our Thin Green Line, that has crunched a lot of projects in the last 7 years. Governor Brown's main opponent is Newt Bueller, and he has voted against very important issues like against undocumented students, against minimum wage proposals, background checks for firearms, against requiring coverage for abortions and contraceptives, against labeling genetically modified fish, and a very important housing issue, preventing landlords from evicting tenants without a cause. So I just hope that people look at the whole package, not just climate, and consider what they can do as well besides voting.
I've been speaking with fossil fuel activist Bonnie McKinley. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Second guest today is Sean Fleek, who's the Community Engagement Coordinator with OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon. Sean, thanks so much for talking with me today. You're going to tell us a little bit about your upcoming event.
Yeah, we're going to be holding the Rise for Climate, Jobs, and Justice Day of Action in solidarity with actions all around the United States and around the world. The Oregon Just Transition Alliance is a statewide alliance of frontline base-building grassroots groups led by people of color and people with low income. That includes rural and tribal communities. We'll be sending a contingent down to San Francisco for the Solutions to Solidarity Summit, but we'll also be holding an event right here in Portland at Glen Haven Park on Saturday, September 8th. And the point of this event is to really show that the climate justice movement in this country exists, to show our decision makers that we not only have demands, but that we intend to enforce them, that we really want to hold accountable our decision makers for their inaction to this point, and that we really draw a lot of connections that people don't necessarily associate with climate. The Oregon Just Transition Alliance has already proposed a three-pronged platform for this event. We oppose Measure 105, the racist anti-immigrant ballot measure that would strike down Oregon's sanctuary city status. We oppose the construction of the Jordan Cove Terminal and the liquid natural gas pipeline through southern Oregon. And we support local initiatives like the Portland Clean Energy Fund, where communities of color actually lead and create policies that would lead to investments in our communities and disinvest from the extractive fossil fuel economy.
Great. It sounds like a great event. Can you tell us again when that is and what the time is?
It's going to be on Saturday, September 8th at Glen Haven Park, which is just off 82nd Avenue and Siskiyou, I believe. And that's at noon that day. And it will run for several hours. We'll have speakers. You'll hear all about the connections to the Just Transition Framework, why we would say that an anti-immigrant measure is a threat to climate justice when you live in a world of climate refugees and white supremacists who want to take control of our democracy and bend it to their will. We believe that Measure 105 is an injustice from a climate perspective. We'll also be talking to folks who oppose the LNG pipeline and who support the Portland Clean Energy Fund.
Okay, great. And we're hoping to have you back on soon, talking a little bit more about the connections between the fossil fuel struggle in the Pacific Northwest and Measure 105. Thank you, Sean.
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, that was just a snippet of perhaps the greatest ecological song ever, Marvin Gaye, Mercy, Mercy Me. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Concluding our program today, longtime Old Mole contributor Norm Diamond interviews Alex Diamond. Alex Diamond has been teaching in Columbia for the past several years. Until recently, he'd been living in a remote community, long an area of struggle between guerrillas, paramilitaries, and the government. He just published an essay in the NACLA report on the implementation of the peace accords between the guerrillas and the government. We'll post a link to that essay on our website. Currently, Diamond is a PhD student in sociology at the University of Texas, Austin. And full disclosure, if you haven't already guessed or assumed, Norm and Alex are father and son. Norm?
Yeah, but which is which, Tom? Let the listeners figure it out. Our theme is Columbia. And with Tom's introduction, clearly Alex is leading an adventuresome life. It's been a while since you've been on the radio. Welcome. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you.
So Colombia, for decades, the U.S. government's closest ally in Latin America. In this country, probably most associated with violence, the reputation of just ongoing violence, murder of trade union leaders, murder of journalists, etc. It would not surprise me if in our conversation those two themes are linked somehow. That is the theme of violence and the connection to U.S. government policy. Tom introduced you as a sociologist, Alex. Within sociology, you're an ethnographer. Tell us what that means, and then we'll get into what you've been doing and how that bears on our larger questions.
Well, the idea of ethnography is that we learn particular things about people, and we come to a deeper understanding of social structures and how people live from interacting with people within their daily lives. Interviews are an important part of ethnography, but not just interviews. Certainly not quantitative research, but actually being with people in their daily lives, in the habitat they live in, seeing, not just asking them what they do, but seeing what they do, seeing their practices, and even participating.
Kind of participation, participant-observer status in this very contentious zone. I guess tell us about Briseño. Tell us about where you've been, social structure, economics. How do people live there before we get into why it's so important to know about that area?
Well, Briseño is a small municipality. The population is about 9,000 in northern Antioquia department of Colombia. And it's particularly crucial to my research because it was an area that had a lot of violence. The FARC, which are the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia.
That's the guerrilla movement.
The guerrilla movement have been there. It originated in the southern eastern part of the country, but they've been there historically since 1981 with constant presence, and more recently been fighting with paramilitaries, like Tom mentioned. But the economy of Briseño was about 90% based on coca, which is the plant that's used to make cocaine. And this has historically been a major driver of the conflict, at least in terms of arming groups, both the guerrillas and paramilitaries, financing them. And it was also the place where the Colombian government chose to launch a pilot substitution program for coca, which was negotiated in the peace accords with the guerrillas.
Taking one step back, and then we want to get to the peace accords, this is just a question out of real curiosity. Was there any kind of a difference between how the guerrilla movement and the paramilitaries related to the production of cocaine, to the growth of coca?
So that's a contentious issue. First, in terms of Colombia as a whole, the guerrillas were resistant to the coca. They even prevented in the late 70s and early 80s at times, prevented campesinos from cultivating coca, and then sort of realized that that was, as the most profitable crop available, that was the only option they had. And they began regulating production and trade. Now, that brought with it a lot of violence, but generally around the country and in Briseño, the guerrillas did support local populations, including, for example, mandating particular salaries for people who worked with the coca. The paramilitaries historically actually forced, and in Briseño, forced people to grow coca, were much more likely to use violence around it. And in Briseño, for example, they often actually did not have money, so they wouldn't pay people for 4 or 5 months. They would force people to continue producing. They wouldn't pay them. And a lot of violence, they prevented people from selling to other groups or other, even private individuals. So they would kill or threaten people who tried to sell their coca outside.
So this is a zone of small farmers, basically. You're not talking about large estates somehow, not industrial agricultural production.
That's a good clarification, yeah. It's all small farmers, many of whom do not own their own property. So there was a lot of tenant farming as well, but small-scale production.
So the peace accords, I mean, it's extremely interesting. The peace accords then impact the economic events and people's possibilities for making a living, even potentially the social structure in the communities.
Yeah, the peace accords, it's really an amazing document, about 300 pages. I won't claim to have read the whole thing. But they have 6 parts, and the parts that are most important to my research are part one is rural reform, an integral rural reform. So a lot of infrastructural development, education, healthcare, roads is a major issue. And part four is crop substitution, not just coca. There's also marijuana and poppies in Colombia, but it's mainly coca. So the peace accords themselves were a recognition that rural violence and the guerrilla struggle has historically come out of state abandonment of rural areas, not just abandonment, I would say campesino dispossession. So there were all these parts of it that were meant, not just the parts that have to do with transitional justice or what the disarming guerrillas get from the agreement, but also having to do with the growth of and social investment in rural Colombia.
One of the things I remember about Colombia is the huge, you mentioned displacement, the huge internal, well, the population that's been moved out of their traditional areas. For what and by whom?
Well, I think now there's about 7 million people in Colombia who are registered as internally displaced. The number would be higher if you take into account how many people are actually displaced. It's a huge number. It's generally violence, people who have had to leave because of violence. A figure that large, each displacement has its own story. A lot are very specific economic means, getting people out of areas so paramilitary groups, to give a little bit of history, paramilitary groups were founded and kind of operate in terms of a counterinsurgent discourse, so that they're supposed to address specifically the guerrilla groups that have existed in the country since 1964, really, of which the FARC is only one. But they've historically been used, and they were controlled by large landowners, they've historically been used, this is just one example of displacements, to get people off lands that have some kind of resource that wealthy large Colombian landowners want. Whether that's gold, which is a major issue in Briceño, whether that's clearing out land to found African palm plantations, whether that's...
What's the African palm for?
Well, it's a bit ironic. This is not an issue in Briceño, but in many parts of Colombia it is, that it's biofuel. So this is European attempts to address global warming, but not just in Colombia. Colombia is probably the place where it's manifested itself in the most violent way. But in a lot of producers in Africa and Indonesia, they've just cleared out huge swaths of jungle to grow these palm trees, and they extract oil from them.
Destroying trees, destroying habitat for ecological or supposedly ecological kinds of purposes.
Right. These are the ironies of capitalism.
They are. And so it's quite fascinating, going back to Briceño and the crop substitution programs, when we read in the papers something so simple as, well, they're converting the production of root material for cocaine, they're converting it to something somehow more salubrious, growing bananas or growing avocados or something like that. Really, there's a huge story behind it, and there are really large social and economic issues, and there's, for that matter, there's a real devastation as well. So, back, tell us more about the crop substitution program. It's part of the peace accords, and you've been there on the ground. What's actually been happening?
So just quickly, the program, which I think is really well designed, gives a year's worth of subsidy payments to families register in the program. They sign an agreement with the government, and they get a year's worth of subsidy payments basically to feed themselves. It's about $350 a month in U.S. dollars to feed themselves as they transition to other crops. So they pull out all their coca. Well, they get the first payment, they pull out all their coca, and they basically have food for a year. And during that year, they're supposed to get goods, not money, but goods to develop other projects on three levels. So there's family farms, short-term productive projects, and long-term productive projects. And the idea is that within the first 2 months, they implement the family farms project to ensure that they have things to eat, subsistence agriculture. Then within the first year, they're supposed to have short-term productive projects going so that when the payments actually end within that year, they have something they can make money off of. Short-term productive projects are like crops that produce quickly. So an example would be they can plant blackberries and be getting a harvest within, I don't know, like 7 months, something like that. And then once the first year ends, they're supposed to implement and get the goods for long-term productive projects. The idea is that this is the economic activity that's going to replace the coca.
Just one quick clarification, something that's intrigued me. When you talk about blackberries, that's obviously not a subsistence crop. Is part of the plan, whether it's working or not, and you still have to tell us about that, is part of the plan to convert them into producing for export somehow?
My understanding of blackberries is that they're not exported outside of the country, but they're sold as either the berry itself or in fruit pulp, which is used to make juice.
So taking subsistence farmers and integrating them more solidly in the market, in any case, although cocaine obviously was...
I don't know that it's actually integrating them more into the market, because in the time of the coca, which was until like a year and a half ago, Briceño, or 2 years ago, basically, Briceño was all coca producing. That was the economy. Well, 90%. There was actually a lot less subsistence agriculture, and people started buying food because the coca was profitable enough. And particularly in areas that were controlled by the paramilitaries, people just used all their land to grow coca. So within the agreement, there's actually a push, as negotiated by the FARC, a push back to subsistence agriculture. It's more integrating people within an illicit market rather than an illicit market.
Okay, so you've described the plan. How's it working?
Basically, the campesinos complied with the agreement. They uprooted their crops very quickly. They were supposed to do it within the first 2 months. They did it earlier, and they sort of sat on their hands waiting for the productive projects to come. And just now, basically a year and 4 months after they pulled out their coca, just now they're getting the first productive projects that they were promised within 2 months, which are the family farms. So not the projects that are supposed to give them money. It's been a really mismanaged process with incredible delays. And as a result, the coca economy disappeared immediately. They pulled it all out, and there's been nothing to replace it. So the economy of the region has collapsed completely.
People are hard hit. These are people you've been living among and knowing and making friends with. What's their response been?
As a researcher, actually, it's amazing because there's a lot of people with a lot of free time. It's not ideal, but people are happy to talk, and you go visit people, and it's in very rural areas. There's a lot of sitting around.
And motivated. If people have the free time, then I imagine there's some unhappiness as well.
Very, very much so. I think there have been three responses. One response is a lot of people have left the area. A lot of people have had to go elsewhere to look for work, whether that's entire families or traditionally the man of the family might go to find daily work. They're called jornales.
Just to clarify, this is a result. We're talking about the results of government failure to comply with the peace accords, essentially.
Exactly, yeah. And it's clear. There's no doubt about that. So many people are leaving. Some people have been able to plant other crops, have done it with their savings, have borrowed money, but the local economy still has completely collapsed. That's not a mischaracterization. And then a third and particularly distressing result is that in the wake of the peace agreement, FARC dissident groups have popped up. There's a narrative about them that it's ex-FARC combatants who wanted to continue the armed life and wanted to continue working in illegal coca economies and often illegal mining economies. But in Briceño, at least, that's not the case. What it's been is young, particularly young men who don't have work, who previously would have been working within the coca economy, who are angry at the government, and the dissident group that has popped up in Briceño is now paying, which the FARC didn't do before. So they're joining, and it's growing rapidly, and that's a very distressing thing for a region that thought that it had gotten past this armed group presence.
So we've read about the peace accords. Here, the government's failure to comply is generating a new guerrilla group, a new insurgent movement in the area you're studying and surrounded by.
Essentially, yes. And historically, the armed groups, not just the guerrillas, but also paramilitaries, have been driven to a large extent by a whole lot of people who don't have better opportunities, who are joining because that's a source of, in some cases, income, particularly the paramilitaries, but food, status. It's the same in this case.
Well, there's a lot I'd like to ask about that, including gender kinds of issues. The FARC itself, of course, was both female and male. You described this as young men in particular. But let's hold that question because we also promised that we'd talk about the U.S. role. Is there U.S. pressure, or how do you understand U.S. policy vis-a-vis all this?
Well, that's very important, especially speaking to an American audience, which I assume I'm doing now. The
tens of thousands of listeners are eagerly awaiting your word, yes.
Well, there's currently in the political climate in Colombia, there was a presidential election. The new president, Iván Duque, took power August 7th. And he's come out against crop substitution. And recently, I think about a week ago, his defense minister came out against crop substitution. And the alternative is forced eradication, which is basically the military going in and pulling out the crops, and also aerial fumigation, which is using glyphosate, a dangerous chemical.
Spraying deadly poisons from the air while the military also moves in, yeah.
Right. So Briceño historically had seen both of those strategies, and what people told me was that people just go back and plant more coca because they're left with, as we're seeing now, they're left without their productive activity. And coca is the crop that they can grow and quickly get money from. So that basically these programs of eradication and fumigation take food out of their children's mouths without offering any sort of alternative. That's why substitution is important. But to get to your question, the U.S. has always pushed for both eradication and fumigation. In 2015, Colombia stopped using glyphosate. They stopped aerial fumigation because it was shown to be carcinogenic. I think there's some debate over that now. It's certainly terrible for water, for children,
no,
for
United
other
Nations
crops.
Has recently declared, acknowledged glyphosate as carcinogenic.
And recently, the U.S. has pushed more and more. And now,
why? How do you understand that? There was the pretense that we were eradicating drugs, and what really was going on was an attack on insurgent movements. But why do they continue now that there are peace accords? Why would the U.S. continue that kind of repressive approach to the population of Colombia?
Well, one thing is this rush and need to get numbers. Not because substitution doesn't work, because I think it would work if it was properly implemented, but because it hasn't been implemented on a wide scale. Coca cultivation has actually gone up in Colombia, and that's something that Trump talks about and has used as an excuse to push for forced eradication and fumigation. Another thing that I don't think we're going to have time to get into, but is that a lot of these areas, these rural areas, have a lot of other natural resources. Briceño, for example, has a lot of gold. So these kind of more military policies allow the state to take control rather than developing rural economies.
State to take control in the interests of foreign capital to come in and extract minerals.
Exactly, which can be gold, or in the wake of the peace agreements, there's been major timber industries popping up in areas where they couldn't before.
As well, the displacement, of course, encouraging the growth of large landed estates. So this is for the elite and for foreign capital.
That's right.
That's quite extraordinary, being in that small community and all the large issues that are implicated. We've been talking with Alex Diamond. Really fascinating kind of experience. Thanks lots, Alex, for illuminating all this.
Thanks for having me.
And back to Tom.
Yeah, thank you, guys. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mo Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Tammy Dean has been our engineer. Tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mo mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. This is KBOO Portland.